And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Wednesday afternoon. Well, this hour we discuss hearing loss. It's usually thought of as the bane of the elderly, but is on the rise among young people as well. Joining us now is Catherine Boughton. She's a New York-based editor and writer. She's also battled baffling hearing loss for decades and has written about it. Her book is Shouting Won't Help, Why I and 50 Million Other Americans Can't Hear You. And she joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome to you, Catherine.
Thank you very much. I was there in Miami with you.
Oh, New when?
It's not so great right now.
Oh, you wish you were. Okay. Well, Catherine, it's astounding that you can be with us today without actually being in our studio and speech reading. What allows you to have this interview today? Is it technology?
Speech reading is really usually essential for me, but I'm in a soundproof studio. I have headphones on. You all are speaking very clearly. There's no background music except in your introduction and in between takes. If there were background music, I probably wouldn't be able to follow what you were saying at all.
So I suppose the engineer kind of cranked up the volume.
I don't have to crank up the volume. That would actually probably hurt my ears. Set pretty well for me.
So tell us, your hearing loss began at a very early age, the age of 30. What happened to you?
I was working at home. I was a writer. I've been an editor for a long part of my life, but I was a writer back then. I was working at home on an article that I was reporting about a dig in Turkey that I had spent 6 weeks at under pretty grueling conditions. It was about 2 months later. And I picked up the telephone in my left hand, as I always did, so I could take notes with my right hand. This was in the days of typewriters and, telephones that sat on your desk. And I said hello, and I didn't hear anything. I said hello again. I tested my hearing by calling things like the weather and time, which you used to be able to do in those days. And eventually I realized I simply was not hearing in my left ear anymore. I thought it was probably temporary. I was, the days of really loud rock concerts. I went to see The Who at Madison Square Garden not long before that. But when it didn't go away, I went to an ear doctor who tested me for all sorts of things, for how bad my hearing was, but also for all sorts of underlying conditions. I had indeed lost a great deal of the hearing in my left ear. My right ear was fine. And I didn't have any underlying conditions that could be detected, so they were unable to explain what the cause of my hearing loss was.
So deafness can be more debilitating than blindness because it isolates you and there's a lack of involvement that blind people can at least participate at a table conversation.
There's this famous Helen Keller quote that everyone likes to quote, saying that blindness is preferable to deafness because deafness cuts you off from the company of men, or the intellectual company of men. I used to agree with that, but as I have gotten more used to my hearing aid and my cochlear implant, as I have learned more about technology, I don't agree with it anymore. It is possible to correct deafness. I can still continue to communicate even without somebody sitting in front of me. I don't really even need to lip read always. But so far, there is really no correction for blindness. They're beginning to get some leads on how to do it. But I would say at this point, deafness is a pretty manageable condition, less so blindness, I believe.
Well, you spent many years trying to hide your hearing loss. Why? Didn't that make you feel even more isolated?
Isolation is a very serious side effect with hearing loss, either untreated hearing loss or even treated serious hearing loss, because hearing aids generally do not have the capacity to bring back the hearing that you once had unless you have a mild or moderate hearing loss. If you have a mild or moderate hearing loss and you don't want to acknowledge it, You may find yourself frustrated in a lot of social situations, work situations, and find yourself withdrawing. That kind of social withdrawal leads to depression, and it can also lead to much more serious consequences later on in life. There's a statistical correlation between hearing loss and an earlier or more serious onset of dementia. This is something that's only been discovered in the past few years. It's not a cause and effect. Nobody really knows what the connection is. But one plausible explanation is that the cognitive effort you're spending on hearing does not leave enough space in your brain left over for memory and for thinking. And so for that reason, it's very, very important to start treating hearing loss right from the start so that you don't use that enormous cognitive effort that it takes to hear when you don't wear hearing aids or when your hearing aids aren't good enough.
Mm.
So you suffer from sensorineural hearing loss, if I pronounced it correctly. Could you explain what that is?
Sure. You did pronounce it correctly. It's the kind of hearing loss that most adults have. It's the kind of hearing loss you get as a result of exposure to noise, from exposure to things that are toxic to your hearing, like certain antibiotics, certain drugs, certain physical conditions like autoimmune disorders, all do the same thing. And what they do is destroy the tiny hair cells in your inner ear that take the sound waves and convert them into the signals that the auditory nerve takes to your brain. So as those hair cells are destroyed, usually not all at once, it's usually not, you know, just a total flat wipeout, but more and more frequencies are lost and it becomes harder and harder to hear. Once the hair cells are destroyed, at this point, there is no way to bring them back again. So this is why prevention is very important. And I think this is becoming something that's people are more aware of now. I see all the time people on riding lawnmowers wearing noise-canceling headphones. I think people are finally realizing that it's not good for their hearing or their health to be exposing themselves to the noise of a lawnmower.
I'm sorry.
I was going to say, by far the majority of the noise people are exposing themselves to now, and noise that is really dangerous, is recreational. The Super Bowl, is this the culmination of the football season? And football is an incredibly loud sport for people sitting in the stadium. You know, the decibel levels can reach 130, 140, well, maybe not 140, but 130, 135, and that is really, really loud and really damaging to your ear.
Well, it was a big part of this year's Super Bowl promotion, Seattle's 12-man business with CenturyLink Field, and that stadium was specifically designed to give more volume to fans.
That's absolutely true, and it's not just Seattle. It's college football, it's basketball, it's pro hockey. The Seahawks Stadium in the last playoff game, they measured 137.5 decibels. That is somewhere between a chainsaw and a jet taking off right over your head.
Well, we want to play something
really loud
for you here at Miami Heat, the world champion Miami Heat. To go to that arena and hear the amount of volume, you really need to have earplugs. And we've got somebody who's just recorded the opening. It was done on a smartphone. Go ahead, Paul. I don't think I'd want to be a part of that. How about you, Bob?
Do you know what the decibel level was there?
No, but it's horrendous.
Catherine, you've mentioned 137 and 135. What is an acceptable decibel level for us that doesn't hurt our ears? Give us the number for that.
It's a combination of the length of time of exposure and the pure noise. So conversation, for instance, quiet conversation in your house is probably about 70 decibels. Decibels are measured, it's an algorithm, so they increase exponentially. So by the time you get to 90 decibels, which is not an uncommon sound level, for instance, in many restaurants, you're way, way, way above the sound of normal, as we all know who've ever eaten at restaurants, the sound of a normal conversation in your living room. So once you get to 120, 125, you know, if you just heard that in a 3-minute clip, it would be okay. It probably wouldn't really hurt your ears. But if you're sitting through a 3.5-hour game, you are doing permanent damage to your hair cells. This is work that some scientists at Harvard have discovered. You will regain your hearing the next day, probably. But what you've done is that you've undermined the structure of the hair cells so that they are going to become much more vulnerable to noise in the future. They're going to be more vulnerable to the kind of hearing loss that comes on with age in general. And so, you know, this may not make you deaf 2 days after the Super Bowl, but it's going to have longer-term consequences. For people, for instance, who work in restaurants, I think, you know, that the consequences for them are quite serious. They're consequential. Those people are in, you know, the 90, 95, 100-decibel environment for their whole work shift. So it's really something we need to pay attention to.
Are younger people more at risk for reasons that they have things not formed yet completely?
Everybody's at risk. I don't really know whether it's possible to say that younger people at risk. There are studies with mice that show that when mice are the equivalent of human 16, 17, 18 years old, that's when they're at their most vulnerable. But nobody has done that kind of study on humans yet. It makes sense, but nobody's done the studies.
Okay. We're speaking with Catherine Boughton. She's a journalist and author and a former New York Times senior editor. She currently is a regular reviewer and contributor to Tuesday's Science Times. And her memoir is Shouting Won't Help. We're going to take a short break and we'll come back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, 20 minutes past 1 o'clock. We resume our conversation with Catherine Boughton about her book, Shouting Won't Help. Catherine, you give advice in the book for how we should speak with the hearing impaired. What are those tips?
Essentially, you want the person with the hearing loss to be able to see you, to see your face, to see your lips. And so all of my recommendations kind of center around that. I say that you should look directly at the person when you speak to them. You should speak clearly and articulately. It's difficult for a person with hearing loss to understand someone who has a very thick mustache or a beard. It's very hard to understand somebody who's talking to you with their mouth full. There's a reason our mothers always told us not to do that. It's difficult if you're looking over the person's head. I mean, if you, the speaker, are looking over the hearing loss person's head, because you really do need to see straight on. The other thing is, if you're interviewing somebody or even just having lunch with them in a restaurant, it's much easier for them to have their back to the wall. It's easier for them to be ideally in a corner. The light should not be silhouetting the speaker's head, because that way the person with hearing loss can't see the speaker. The title of my book comes from this same list of how to talk to people with hearing loss, which is that shouting won't help. Don't shout, and even more than that, don't lean into a person's ear and whisper, or shout, for that matter. If I can't see the person's lips, I can't really hear. And somebody shouting in my ear is just a lot of noise in my ear, nothing that I can comprehend.
I guess it's kind of a natural thing when people can't hear you. It must be so frustrating because they talk louder and they do tend to shout. And so it's very it's very good advice, at least to find out that that doesn't work.
It's like someone trying to communicate with somebody who speaks another language. They think by going louder, the person will understand better.
Right. But also, I think one of the real benefits of acknowledging hearing loss instead of pretending that you're just fine, which I did for many, many years, is that you can say, I can hear you much better if you slow down and speak articulately and clearly and at a normal tone of voice. So, you know, there are many, many advantages to being open about the fact that you have hearing loss, but that's one of the major ones.
What are the other reasons to be open about it? Because I did want to get back to that. Why do people hide the fact that they have a hearing loss? Why did you hide it? Is it because there's a stigma? Were you afraid of, what were you afraid of?
Well, traditionally, hearing loss has been associated with aging. And if you say hearing loss, your image is as an old man wearing some kind of big clunky hearing aid in his ear. In fact, hearing loss affects people of every age, and more than 50% of the people with hearing loss in this country are under the age of 55. It does get worse as you get older, and people who are older are not as concerned about the stigma of appearing old because they already are old, so they're more likely to acknowledge it, which reinforces the idea that hearing loss is a condition of aging. So I worked at the New York Times, and it's a very young, ambitious, competitive culture, and I didn't want to be seen as someone who is aging. And so I thought that I would do better by just faking it. And what I didn't know was that by faking it, I was actually giving an impression of being aloof or uninterested or snobbish, or even sometimes probably stupid. It was not at all to my benefit to deny my hearing loss for so many years. The other thing is that once you begin to acknowledge hearing loss, you realize that there are a whole lot of other people out there who are like you. And one of the best things that's happened to me since I opened up about my hearing loss is that I've become friends with many other people with hearing loss. So I joined the Hearing Loss Association of America, which is a national organization with many local chapters, including some great chapters in Florida. The Sarasota chapter just read my book in their book club, and they look like an incredibly lively, fun group to be part of. So it's, you know, that support from people who are going through the same thing you are on the local level is very, very, it's a great benefit of coming out about hearing loss.
What's that organization again? The Hearing Loss Association of America?
It's the Hearing Loss Association of America, and the initials are HLAA. They have a website, and on the website you can find all the local chapters. The national organization is an advocacy group primarily, and they spend a lot of time advocating for people with hearing loss, for equal access, for changes in laws. For instance, Medicare does not cover hearing aids right now in most circumstances, and the national HLAA is part of a movement to try to change the Medicare laws so that they pay for hearing aids.
Nor do most health insurance plans, correct?
Most health insurance plans do not. A couple are starting to offer a plan where you buy the insurance through, United Healthcare has a plan where you buy the insurance through them. They offer certain brands of hearing aids. I am not completely familiar with it, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. Medicaid, interestingly, does not pay for hearing aids, which is, I think, is very short-sighted on the part of, on the state level, because states end up paying unemployment insurance
right,
or even welfare to people who can't work because they can't hear, because they can't afford to buy hearing aids.
That seems really shocking that they would not pay for it. But what about the Affordable Care Act?
That does not now cover hearing aids either.
Our telephone number, if you'd like.
I know. It stops me dead every time I say that.
Really?
We'll have links to that organization at the Topical Currents Facebook page.
Is it HLAA.org?
Yes, Hearing Loss Association of America.
Okay.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or a question of Catherine Boughton, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email, that's radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Catherine Boughton, I think a lot of people think that hearing loss is a loss of volume or amplitude of sound, but actually it's more important about amplitude and frequency. When your high frequencies are cut off, you can't hear the difference between, say, F and S. Is that how you found it?
Yes, actually, most people, when they first start to develop hearing loss, don't actually realize that they have any loss of hearing. They're simply unable to understand speech, especially in noise. And that's because the frequencies where those speech sounds are mostly found are often the ones that go first. So if you if you find yourself having a hard time hearing in a restaurant and everybody else seems to be doing okay, or at one of those football or basketball games and some other people seem to be doing okay, that's a very very good sign that you are actually in the early stages of hearing loss. And it's important to get that hearing loss checked out, because hearing loss can be a symptom of an underlying condition that you may not know about. It might be a symptom of an autoimmune disorder, of cardiovascular disease. So just for health reasons, it's important to find out whether or not you do have a hearing loss and if it could have been caused by any of those things. But also, the earlier you treat hearing loss, the less demand is put on your brain cognitively. So very, very mild hearing loss, probably, you can get away with it. Mild hearing loss, there are options on the market that aren't a $3,000 hearing aid. They're just basically personal sound amplifiers. They're very controversial, but I think most people are coming around to thinking that as a first step, especially for people who can't afford very expensive hearing aids. They will allow you to keep on being able to hear enough to be part of a conversation, and then when you max out on them, then it's time to go get a real hearing aid. But there are a lot of sort of lesser steps that you can take to continue to be able to hear pretty well. And I really believe that it's important to take those steps early on.
What about, you hear so many troubles with them. I have a friend who just got them. I mean, be it the sound, the fit, the discomfort, the expense. How difficult are they to get used to?
Hearing aids?
Yes.
They should fit properly. If they're uncomfortable or if they itch, it means they're not fitted properly. That most hearing aids for people with mild to moderate hearing loss are what's called open fit. And so it's just a tiny little, it's like a tiny little sponge that is in the inside of your ear. Not the inside, but inside, the outside part of your ear. And then it's hooked to, by a almost invisible wire, to a small device behind your ear. Those are easy to fit, and they shouldn't really give you any discomfort at all. For more serious hearing loss, you need the kind that's actually fits the shape of your ear exactly, so that air doesn't get through and so the sound isn't distorted. But most people, when they buy hearing aids, they're offered either the hearing aid or a package. And it's always wise to buy the package, because you are going to need to go back to the audiologist and have that hearing aid adjusted. As you learn to hear better with it, it's going to need to be reprogrammed to give you even better hearing with it. And if it doesn't seem right, there's something wrong with it. There are, I don't hear perfectly with my hearing aid now, but I have almost no hearing in the ear that I have a hearing aid in. So I'm not really a great hearing aid candidate anymore. And in fact, I probably will get another cochlear implant in the next year or two. But for most people with normal hearing loss, hearing aids should work pretty well for them.
We just have a quick email, or we need to go to a break, and we want to get to your cochlear implants. But Peter says, I have expensive digital hearing aids for mostly high-frequency hearing loss. They are advertised as being able to isolate a single speaker's voice in a noisy environment. I have found this not to be the case. Is there such a capability in any hearing aid? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, I'm not an audiologist, but I would say that that's an exaggerated claim. I don't think that, I don't know how serious that person's hearing loss is. I don't know what kind of hearing aid it is or how it was fitted. But I don't think there's any kind of a hearing aid that's going to be able to isolate a single voice in a very noisy environment. And in fact, many hearing aid manufacturers also make assisted devices that you use with the hearing aid that, for instance, would be a microphone that you would hold up right to the speaker. So that way you might hear that speaker's voice directly in your ear. But otherwise, in a noisy place, I think that's a claim that probably can't be supported.
We're speaking with Catherine Boughton. She's a journalist, and her book is entitled, it's a memoir, actually, Shouting Won't Help, Why I and 50 Million Other Americans Can't Hear You. We'll take a short break and come back with your calls and emails. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Catherine Boughton. We're talking about her book, Shouting Won't Help. And, of course, we're talking about hearing disorders.
I wonder if we could go back to that previous caller's question for a minute, because I think it's a very, very important issue that he's raising. People do not know how to buy hearing aids. It's an incredibly complicated, competitive business. There's some dishonesty in it. It's something that I think that everybody who's involved with the hearing loss community, professionals and consumers like me, are aware of. And so I feel very sad when I hear a story like that one. I don't know where that person got his hearing aids, but it's very important to go to a good audiologist. That good audiologist can be at a medical center. It can be at a big box store. Some of them, Costco, I think, has audiologists on staff. There should be follow-up built into the purchase of your hearing aid. You need to be able to just keep on working and working and working at it. And so for somebody to have a $3,000 hearing aid that 6 months later is not working for them gives hearing aids a very bad name, and it shouldn't. 6 months later, he should have a hearing aid that is working fine for him. He and his audiologist should have been working together. And
I think they did.
Don't seem that interested. So
I think they did work together, and I think he did have other appointments. So how do you know how to find a good one? I mean, is there an association that has a list of names that are approved?
I don't think so. What happened to me was that when I first went to have my hearing tested, my ENT gave me a list of 8 audiologists in the in the general geographic area, and I chose one of them based on geography, mm-hmm. essentially. But you can also go on, again, the HLAA website talks a lot about how to find a good audiologist. You have to explore your way through that website. The National Institute for Deafness and Other Communication Disorders, NIDCD, also is a very useful website for information on finding audiologists, different kinds of hearing aids, just all the options. There's no one place that I know of where everything's put together in a clear and simple way. And in fact, I'm thinking of writing another book that would actually go through and lead people through the process and put it all in one place. Because I think many, many people with hearing loss are really at a loss of how to proceed with having it tested, with correction, with
right.
All sorts of issues, social and economic and professional issues. So I think this is a field that is needs to be available and clearly laid out in book form or in some other form. But those are two good websites.
Okay. And do you know if they're both .org? Is that NIDCD.org?
Yes. National Institute of Deafness and Other Communication Disorders.
Right. Okay.
Well, we have a lot of calls, of course. First up, it's James in Fort Lauderdale. Thanks for your patience, James. Hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to speak to two things. Decibel levels that you find in venues like clubs and bars, even movie theaters now. It seems to me just because we have the technology, should we be using it at such decibel levels? Because I'm a local musician here in South Florida, and so many places that I play, when we go on a break and the DJs play, the decibel level is just excruciating. I've been saying for a long time that we're going to have an epidemic of people with hearing loss for this reason alone. And I'm wondering, is there any regulation or is it just a free-for-all? I know regulation can be a dirty word in the current political climate, and at the same time, to me, it's dangerous. And I also wanted to ask about, have you had any success with lipoflavonoids? Thank you very much.
Okay.
I didn't get your second question.
Lipoflavonoid?
Yes, she got it.
Okay. To your first question, noise is regulated pretty well in the workplace. OSHA does a good job of mandating at what decibel level you can work for what number of minutes or hours a day. In other kinds of environments, there are noise ordinances in most municipalities. They aren't enforced. People don't care. They'll enforce the noise ordinance about people smoking and talking too loudly outside a bar, but they don't go inside the bar and enforce the noise ordinance inside the bar. So this is, we need community awareness of this. People need to start complaining, asking for the decibel level to be lowered in places that they frequent. It's the kind of thing where if you don't ask for it, you're not going to get it. I do know myself that I've been in restaurants and somebody has said, could you please turn down the sound? And they say, well, everybody else likes it. So if everybody else doesn't like it, we should all be saying it's too noisy in here. We'd like to hear the people
You'll like this, Catherine. I was in a neighborhood Italian restaurant over the holidays and they were playing Christmas songs at this tremendous level and the chipmunks came on. And I just felt so ridiculous hearing. So I got the waitress over and said, could you turn that down? And they were oblivious.
Background music in restaurants, I don't understand why it's there ever, because it already, all by itself, before anybody begins talking, before any dishes start clattering, before, all those busboys start dumping the dishes into the bin behind you. I mean, it's already noisy enough just with the normal workings of a restaurant. But then to add very, very audible so-called mood music is... It just really raises it higher. There's some very interesting studies about that. There were a couple that were done in France a few years ago that show that raising the decibel level in a bar means that people drink one beer every 15 minutes at a sort of normal decibel level and one beer every 7 minutes at a much higher decibel level. Wow. Also, restaurants, if they encourage fast eating, if they want a quick turnover of their tables, if they have, sort of very loud, exciting music, the kind of not Chopin in the background, you'll chew faster. And so they can turn more tables over in an evening. So
we had someone write in that say that the American Airlines Arena, which is where the Heat play, says there is an OSHA complaint against the arena for Heat games and other events.
I didn't hear what you said. Sorry.
The AAA arena, where that sound cut came from, someone has written in that there's an OSHA complaint against the arena for heat games and other events.
That's good.
We have an emailer that Corinne says she just finished a 45-minute exercise class, a spinning class, where the music was so loud that her ears are literally still ringing from it. I was wondering if this could be damaging my hearing.
Yes. I think so.
Yes.
She should wear earplugs and she should ask them to turn the noise down. But I know that spinning classes in particular think that they need that music to keep you pumping away on your bike. Of course, many, many athletes use music to pace themselves and to make them work harder. There are all sorts of workout tapes you can download that people in gyms play very, very loudly through their earbuds. That's not doing them any good either.
Let's take another caller. This is Janet in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi.
Hi. Catherine, I wanted to tell you how much your book meant to me. it meant the world. I'm not quite sure how I came across it. I have hearing loss. I've been wearing hearing aids for 4 years. It's been difficult getting used to them because I lived in such a quiet world for so long. And when I first got my hearing aids, I couldn't believe that my feet made noise when I walked outside. It was just a revelation. But what your book did for me was it explained everything about being in big open places, background noise, even small things in my house. But it helped me with my close friends. They were difficult. They were, why don't you turn your hearing aid up? Why don't you put it in? And so I sent my book to many of them and lent my book to many of them. And it just really brought them to a place where they understand how hard it is for me and how tiring it can be. And one of my friend's husbands read this and he went out and got hearing aids. So there's no way I can say thank you enough for the book that you wrote.
Well, thank you very much. That's very moving to hear you say that. And I get a lot of email from people who say the same thing. But what one thing you said that is different from what others say is that you gave the book to your hearing friends. And I think it's very important that people who are live with or are working with or people in the medical profession, social workers, they all need to understand what hearing loss is because a lot of their clients have it. And, you know, I think you probably remember before you had your hearing corrected that, you know, you can be, seem to be angry all the time or depressed or not all that pleasant to be around. And it's a real sign of hearing loss. And it's very easy to brush that off as just, you know, that this person is just cranky or this person is just getting old and, you know, losing her memory. That's why she can't. That's why she's answering my questions incorrectly. It often is hearing loss. And so I really think that it's important that anybody, especially in the medical professions and the social worker and kind of professions, learn to recognize the signs of hearing loss.
Okay, Janet, thank you.
Thank you for calling, Janet.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're speaking with journalist Catherine Boughton. Her memoir is Shouting Won't Help, Why I and 50 Million Other Americans Can't Hear You. One more short break, and we'll be back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and journalist Catherine Boughton. We're talking about her memoir, Shouting Won't Help. And we have an emailer, Kara. Catherine, she says, the first hospital I was in did not call an ENT or give me the correct needed medication. It's an infection. Correct diagnosis and medication is important to restore your hearing in an infection. I'm now extremely hearing impaired. Please let everyone know that immediate treatment's important. P.S. My hearing aids aren't what the commercial claim is either for hearing in noisy conditions.
What she says about immediate treatment, especially with sudden hearing loss, is absolutely essential. A lot of times you can, with sudden hearing loss, you can restore, the hearing loss may come back on its own, or a doctor may treat it with steroids, which often help the hearing to come back. But it has to be done within a very short period of time of the hearing loss. So there are all sorts of reasons to immediately go to an MD and preferably an ENT to try to figure out what's happened to you. Losing your hearing overnight is not a normal thing.
Okay.
But even if you just have realized that slowly you've been losing your hearing, that's the point where you should also go to an ENT and see if you can figure out what's been going on. It's really important not to ignore it.
I suppose it's almost like brakes slowly going bad in a car that you're not aware of it.
It's true. When I don't have my hearing aids on, I constantly leave the water running, which drives my husband crazy. And when I put my hearing aids on, even in the next room, all of a sudden I hear the water still crashing into the bathroom sink. But when I look at water running and I don't hear it, it doesn't occur to me that I'm not hearing it. I figure that water running into the sink doesn't make any noise. It's the same thing with walking and rustling leaves or, you know, patting a cat. You think the purring is a tactile sensation. It's actually also an auditory sensation. And
right.
So it's easy not to notice that you're not hearing.
Let's take another caller, Darlene. She's in Pompano Beach. Hi there.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I used to be told about 10 years ago when I was in my 30s that by my siblings that I had a selective hearing, and I think that a lot of it comes from going to loud concerts and, you know, thinking I was cool standing next to the speakers. And now in my late 40s, I'm paying for that. It's come to a point where when I'm watching my granddaughter, if she even screams with a high pitch, it sends needles down my spine from the pain in my ear. And I was wondering, is there any kind of regulations on these earbuds also that these young kids are wearing with their iPhones and iPads and things like that? Because I've been on the train and these kids are sitting four or five seats from me and I can hear their stereo with their earbuds in their ears.
Catherine?
Thank you.
If you can hear it, it's too loud. I know that iPods and other MP3 players today do have noise caps. In the old days of Walkman, which you may remember, you could turn those things up so loud. The difference was that you weren't wearing earbuds. You were probably just wearing earphones, over your ears. And so the sound wasn't being directed directly into your, through your hearing, through your eardrum. So, yes, they are doing damage to themselves. And if your granddaughter's sitting in the seat next to you in the car and you can hear every word of whatever she's listening to, she should be turning it down. We do have a little bit of protection built in, but not enough. And again, as I said earlier, it also depends on the length of time of exposure. So if your granddaughter's only listening for 15-minute segments, it's probably not going to do her any harm. If she's listening, she's a teenager, she's got earbuds in from the time she gets up in the morning until the time she goes to bed at night, and they're dialed up as loud as she can get them, that's not good.
Catherine, I wanted to get to your cochlear implant. Is it a last resort, and can you tell us the upside, the downside of them?
Cochlear implants generally are, at this point, considered a last resort. When you can no longer hear well enough with hearing aids, because the hearing aid technology can really only take you so far, the cochlear implant can pick up at that point and take over. The cochlear implant works totally differently from a hearing aid. It is the sound comes into the brain through an implanted device, and it's in a digital form. It's X's and O's, and it's sent down to the cochlea where the cochlear receptors measure what they hear as different frequencies and as noise. They're hard to get used to. For some people, can hear perfectly immediately, but some people have trouble learning to hear with a cochlear implant. It's very good to have some kind of organized rehabilitation program afterwards, either at home on your own or at a hearing center. The other thing is that we haven't talked about is cochlear implants for children, which is it remains a very controversial issue in the deaf community, the ASL speaking community. But 90% of children who are born deaf are born to hearing parents. And those parents, if they decide to go the direction of a cochlear implant, need to think very, very quickly about what they're going to do, because the ideal age for implanting a child is between 6 and 18 months before their speech pathways are fully formed. And those children who receive implants early on seem to do really, really well with them. They hear very, very well with them. But it's a decision that has to be made really early on, and it's surgery. And, you know, the idea of doing surgery on your six-month-old is terrifying, but it's worth it. It is, by the way, even for adults, it's not a difficult surgery for the person having the surgery done. It is difficult surgery for the surgeon. You don't want to be somebody's first implant patient, but, and you don't even really want to be their 50th. You want somebody who's done this a lot of times. But okay. for the person getting the implant, it's an outpatient surgery. It doesn't take very long. You know, there's a scar that's fairly small. It doesn't take a particularly long time to heal. And it's actually an amazingly easy process considering the benefit that you get from it. It is also almost always paid for by insurance, including Medicaid and Medicare. Medicare will pay for one. I don't think they'll pay for two.
That's interesting that would be, and the hearing aids aren't.
Yeah. Well, you know, the government does a lot of strange things.
Well, I'm sorry that we're out of time because we have lots of callers and emails that we haven't gotten to, but we will have links on our website to the associations that Catherine Boughton has told us about. And she is a contributor to Tuesday's Science Times and a former senior editor at the New York Times. And her book, her memoir, is entitled Shouting Won't Help, Why I and 50 Million Other Americans Can't Hear You. Catherine Boughton, it's been a pleasure, and we wish you all the best. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you. And also, I'd like to encourage people to ask those questions to me directly. You can go on my website, which is katherinebouton.com, and my email address is there. And I'm always happy to exchange emails with people if I can be helpful.
Oh, great. Well, thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that wraps up today's edition. Really, we apologize to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. You can find free audio archives of this and past programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information and links as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with Mark Paston, the CEO of the Council of Ethical Organizations. Also, Linda Gastenheimer highlights FIU's renowned School of Hospitality with its dean, Mike Hampton. Calendar time. On this day in 1878, 136 years ago, inventor Thomas Edison patents the gramophone. Audio was recorded on a tinfoil sheet wrapped around a grooved cylinder. Sound made indentations in the foil. And on this day in 1953, 61 years ago, William Inge's Picnic premieres in New York. A Pulitzer Prize winner, it was young Paul Newman's Broadway debut. One more while we remember Maverick Florida Governor Claude Kirk. On this day in 1968, 46 years ago, the first statewide strike by teachers in the U.S. begins in Florida. Pat Tornillo and the Dade County Classroom Teachers Association were at the forefront. Not much was gained. Decades later, Tornillo served federal prison time for corruption. He died in 2007. So we leave with a thought from William Inge, creator of Comeback Little Sheba and Bus Stop as well. Quote, "Worry is interest paid on trouble before it falls due." Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned. Next, it's Here and Now from NPR News.